Welcome to the Bike Show with me, Jack Thurston. It's been a while, but it's good to be back for a spring season. I've been busy finishing my latest book, Lost Lanes North, and that's why there's been a bit of an extended break in the podcast. The book is out in May, and I will let you know fairly shortly how you can order it if you want to. So when I began making plans for the new season of the podcast, I had no idea it would be taking place during the biggest global health emergency for a century. With Britain and many other countries in a coronavirus lockdown, it's going to be hard for me to get out and about riding my bike and recording podcasts. In fact, such behaviour is actively discouraged. So I've been using my bike just really to do essential local journeys to buy food and to get a bit of exercise. The last decent ride I had was last week, a few days before the lockdown came into effect. And that is the subject of this episode of the podcast. I went for a ride with Dr. Ian Walker, an environmental psychologist from the University of Bath. Ian came to global fame about 15 years ago with an experiment that he did, measuring how close he was being passed by overtaking cars, depending on what he was wearing and how he looked. The results of the experiment went viral, and as well as breaking new ground in transport research, they established Ian as the second most famous cross-dressing cyclist in Britain, only eclipsed, perhaps, by national treasure Grayson Perry. And like Grayson Perry in his prime, Ian is a very accomplished bike rider, specialising in ultra-long-distance racing. He was a high-placed finisher in the Transcontinental Race. He won the North Cape 4000 race, and last year set a new world record for riding the length of Europe in a north-south direction. We met up a couple of days, as I said, before the coronavirus lockdown, and went for a spin on roads west of Abergavenny in southeast Wales, near where I live. Along the way, we talked about Ian's research work, as well as how he discovered his talent for riding eye-wateringly long distances without stopping. Ian's arrived. We're in St John's Square in Abergavenny, just outside the post office, which was our appointed rendezvous point. And I watched Ian come over from Bristol on Google Maps location sharing, which is brilliant. Welcome to Abergavenny.
Hello. Yes, I had to ride through a cloud to get here. So as soon as I crossed the Severn, the cloud descended. I got completely soaking wet, but it's lovely over here now.
You made it. Well, it's a very subdued day here. This is the Tuesday market day, normally the busiest day in Abergavenny, after the announcements yesterday about the new restrictions due to coronavirus. So I'm almost feeling like, is it taboo to be out riding a bicycle?
Yeah, and I think one of the things that occurred to me on the way over was we've not yet thought of a name for this situation we're in, because I'm sure in a year from now, 2 years, we'll be looking back and saying, oh, do you remember the whatever it is? And this feels like you're in 1914 going, oh, the trouble in Belgium. And we've not yet thought of a name for this really strange global situation we found ourselves in. And we're going to sound really out of touch when people hear this in the future, once society has settled on what we're going to call this.
Oh, well, take that as a health warning, along with all the other ones. Now, you've ridden over from Bristol, and you've got to get back to Bristol for 4 o'clock. Fortunately, you're a world record-breaking long-distance cyclist, so that should be no problem. But we are in a little bit of time pressure. My aim today is to take you up the Usk Valley from Abergavenny to Crickhowell, and then we're going to go up a road which I normally don't ride on because it's got too much traffic on. But because of a landslip during the recent floods, it's been closed, and it looks like it might be closed for a number of months. So it's completely available for us on our bicycles to ride up, and we'll see how far we get up there, and then probably just come back and let you get your head down and get back to Bristol.
Amazing. Looking forward to it.
All right, well, we'll head out of Abergavenny. I'm going to take you up Neville Street, and then we'll go down the newly de-motor traffic-ised town centre street of Frogmore Street.
Cool.
So we're just going to stop here, Ian, and now this is the corner of Frogmore Street outside the Abergavenny Coliseum, which is now probably rather empty Wetherspoons. And this street used to have continuous traffic coming up here. It was a main carriageway with pedestrians shunted to the very sides of the roadway. And now it's been paved over and the traffic has gone, apart from for deliveries between 4 p.m. and 10 a.m. in the morning. So you're an environmental psychologist. Analyse that.
Even in today's climate, it is bustling with people going about their business, socialising with each other, shopping. And I will make a prediction, even without seeing the local news, I'll bet all the retailers said this will be the end of the town, everything will collapse, and we will all close. And here we are, because this happens in every town that ever proposes these things, and it's looking great.
Yeah, well, I was involved in the group of people that kind of made this happen from the local community as a sort of cycling rep. And there was a lot of opposition. There was a backlash at the last minute, led by, I don't think he'll mind me saying, because it was all over the newspapers, by the guy who runs a fish and chip shop called The Codfather. And he is a formidable character in the town. And he attended a couple of meetings where he really, the councillors were quivering in their boots and were ready to roll over. We managed to hold the line because we basically said, this is going to be dangerous. Mm-hmm. You know, now it's been paved, to have traffic coming around here with no curbs. And he sort of harumphed. Once it was opened, and he was able to put tables and chairs outside his chippy, and my wife, who's a landscape designer, did these planters right outside. He was bringing them cups of tea. He was saying, is there anything you need? Don't worry about these plants. They will be protected at all times. You know, I mean, he completely changed 180 degrees.
Yeah, and yet I was in a local petrol station picking up some cakes the other day because I have to fuel my rides. And I saw in a, yet again, local paper, town centre chaos predicted as pedestrianisation comes. And we've got to stop having this debate. It's been proven over and over again that it's not a problem. Let's just sort our town centres out and remember that they're for people, not for driving through.
All right, well, let's roll down. Giving way to pedestrians at all times.
Of course.
Well, we've run the gauntlet of the A40 from Abergavenny to just beyond Crickhowl. Not a nice road, that one, is it?
No, it gets quite busy.
And you're kind of being passed by a combination of big livestock carrying lorries and the occasional lorry carrying a whole load of straw bales or massive logs from some redwood forest somewhere. And then sort of impatient parents on the school run and white van man.
And of course, you're at the edge of the road that's been smashed to pieces by all the heavy traffic as well.
But by total contrast, we've taken a right turn onto the it's the A479, I think, that goes up through Tretower and Cwm Dŷ. It used to be just a very quiet little lane before it became a trunk road, and goes up over the western edge of the Black Mountains, over a little pass called Pengenforth, into the Wye Valley. So this is a connecting route from the Usk Valley into the Wye Valley. And anyone who's ridden the Brian Chapman Memorial Audax ride, the 600 kilometre Welsh end-to-end, will know this road from kind of early on in the ride. I don't ride it very often because it's got a little bit too much traffic for my tastes, but because of this landslip, it's empty, isn't it? We're just riding along like in the adverts.
It is.
Shoulder to shoulder.
Side by side, chatting away. It's amazing. You never get this in Britain.
Do this. So, Ian, you first came to my attention many years ago, actually, and probably kind of hit the headlines worldwide, really, with a experiment you did about cycling and cross-dressing.
Yeah, well, this was shortly after I started working at the University of Bath, and I'd come out of a research job that wasn't very satisfying. Didn't really enjoy working in that area that much. And so once I got the job at Bath, I thought, I need to find a thing I can do. I need to find something that excites me. And I spent quite a few months trying to think, what area can I do? Something, I want to do something that's useful, something that makes a difference to people, but I couldn't decide what. And then one day I was cycling to work and had people driving quite dangerously around me, and I thought, okay, I could do this. And started a whole process of trying to study how drivers interact with cyclists on the road. So yeah, I did a few things. I started off with a few studies showing drivers pictures of junctions with cyclists and trying to look at what signals people picked up on to work out where cyclists were going to turn and so on. And then I started looking at overtaking, which it's an interesting one, overtaking, because it's not where most collisions happen, but when they do, they're quite serious. So it really matters to understand how much space drivers leave when they come past you.
It's also really off-putting. It's one of those things that they come up behind you and you kind of like jump out of your skin.
Yeah, and actually there's been some really good research in the last maybe 5 years showing what a disincentive it is to people cycling by other researchers. So I spent a sort of a happy summer cycling around a couple of different cities in the UK, trying out different ideas about what might affect the amount of space drivers leave, and recorded passing measurements from about 2,200 drivers.
So how did you do that? What did the tape measure?
No, I found a very useful and clever electronics technician at work who built an ultrasonic distance kit. Now, it's amazing how the technology's changed. So when we did this back in 2005, I was having to carry around a laptop and a car battery and all this sort of stuff to power the kit. When I decided to do some more work on this area in 2013, I was able to knock up my own kit in a box of about 20 centimetres across for under £100. So the technology and the democratisation of electronics is just incredible.
So you went along and recorded all these measurements, and but what was the experiment? Just that, just what? Some cars passed me close and some cars passed me far.
No, but there was an experimental aspect to it. So I tried manipulating things in my behaviour to see what made a difference. So the original one, the one I was most interested in to start with... Good overtake there, that's fine. The one I was interested in at first was riding position on the road. So there was all this debate going on at the time online of... some people were saying, I reckon if I ride out towards the middle of the lane, drivers give me more space when they pass. I saw someone saying, whatever you leave, they'll leave you the same again. And I thought, oh, I don't know. And other people were saying, oh, I think the complete opposite is true. And I thought, well, let's test this objectively. So a big part of the study was riding at different positions to see what difference that made. And then as I was planning this and floating ideas with other people, a couple of other suggestions were mooted. One of them was, well, there's a couple of simple ones, like, do different vehicles respond differently and so on.
Audi drivers.
Exactly.
Really bad. White van man, really bad.
Interestingly, 4x4s were no different back then. I'd love to test that again. One idea was, would wearing a helmet make a difference, which is a particular thing that's become a bane of my life ever since. And another was, are men treated different to women? So that's where the bit that everyone remembers happened.
Of you in a blonde wig.
Yeah. Well, actually, interestingly, not blonde. Back in those days, I had dark hair and I had a dark wig. But what's really... There's something really interesting about the fact everyone assumes it was blonde.
Well, I thought you maybe did a brunette wig and a blonde wig and then to measure the difference.
No, that'd be a good follow-up. But interestingly, what's nice with that is since then, other researchers have done this with real men and women and found the same thing. So that got replicated over in Taiwan, got replicated in Florida. But interestingly,
the point being, it's not the length of your hair, but your sex.
Actual gender, yeah. Interestingly, the one place where they didn't see that was Australia, where I think they're equal opportunities, bad overtakers.
I mean, you know what? Something, I mean, all the Australian listeners to the podcast, I'm really sorry, but I'm never going to ride a bike in your country. I'm just not going to do it. It just sounds horrible.
Yeah, same here. And, you know, you see the hate and the invective that manages to make its way round the globe to us from you. So I can't imagine what you guys actually get.
No, hats off to you.
Yeah.
And putting up with it.
Yeah. And for me, the final straw was seeing how the police treated Mike Hall being killed over there.
Oh, yeah.
In the Indy Pack race. And the kind of casual way that a death was just waved away like that. So, yeah, I'm not sure I'll be cycling in Australia anytime soon.
So your findings were what, in a nutshell?
That some things do affect how much space drivers leave. You know, they were, on average, obviously it's all averages, but on average they were more generous passing women than men. Generally, riding further into the road didn't get you as much space as you'd think. So the more you ride out, the closer they're actually passing you. And you know, in the controversy that never goes away, I found that when I was wearing a helmet, there was a tendency to pass that little bit closer.
And what about the strategic wobble, as advocated by Graham O'Bree, a Scottish cyclist, very successful track cyclist? He advocates a sort of wobble to make yourself look a bit incompetent.
Yeah, I've never measured it, but I suspect he's probably right. The thing is, I mean, this brings us on to a really important, interesting debate, which is, can we, or should we in any way, try to address the safety of vulnerable people in the street by saying to them, well, it's your job to surprise people passing you, to think of new and inventive ways to take them off guard. And
oh, so the Mary Poppins thing, isn't it? Of cycling along in a great big dress with, you know, a huge hat and looking daft.
Yeah.
Because people notice you. Because I guess what a lot of cyclists feel is that people just don't look, don't notice, and maybe don't care that much.
Yeah, exactly. And this is the thing. You see so much of, oh, you know, you should be wearing this, you should be wearing that, you should be wearing a helmet, you should be wearing bright colours. And I just want to say, you know, there's no jersey bright enough to make somebody look up from their phone. There's no jersey bright enough to make certain bigoted drivers believe that you pay road tax. You know, you're not going to overcome these things by dressing how they want. And you can dress exactly right, and it won't actually make any difference in the end. For these extreme people, obviously, you know, there might be some benefits to wearing certain items in certain circumstances, but you'll never do enough to satisfy the people whose demands are more political and practical.
And so did your research kind of advance the field outside our little world of cycling?
So yes, there's been quite a lot of follow-up work in the scientific literature. The study gets cited a lot, several hundred citations since. But I think what's been really interesting, and I absolutely cannot claim all the credit for this, but there's been a new lease of life in cycling research. So I remember 2005 in Nottingham, I was at the International Traffic and Transport Psychology Conference, and it's quite a big event. It's everyone in the field goes there. And in 2005, in the cycling session, there was something like 350 researchers in the next room talking about the driver behaviour questionnaire, and in the cycling session there was me and three guys in Finland, and that was it. Like, literally four people in a room telling each other about research. The next time that conference came around, there was more, and then the time after that, so 8 years later, 2013, it was standing room only in big rooms to talk about cycling.
What, all aspects of cycling?
Yeah, cycling research, cycling safety research. So
what do you think explains that?
I don't know. I think maybe it was just its time came. I do know, I mean, I'm trying to answer this without claiming any credit.
No, go ahead, come on.
Well, that original study I did went absolutely crazy around the world. I think because some of the findings were surprising or counterfactual or just quirky, like me wearing a wig, it got so much attention. I did like hundreds of media interviews around the world. It got to a point, I'd done so many, I was doing radio interviews on the phone whilst writing emails to other people, because I'd answered the question so many times it had become second nature. And it, you know, that era did generate a lot of interest in the whole issue of scientific approaches to traffic safety.
Do you think there's also a dawning realisation that cycling, if you just look at it, it's a really efficient way of getting around, really sensible use of resources, yeah, convenient, accessible, democratic, and good for your health. Well, but why does nobody do it? Suddenly you think, well, we've got this amazing technology and nobody's using it. There must be a psychological explanation of this. And then, you know, start your research project, and then I guess you find out that it's all because we've got no bike lanes.
Oh, do you know, you've actually just hit the nail on the head. So there's a lot of things, and, you know, I can point to various pretty important psychological, social factors, like it's not normal. Most people do what most people do. You know, we're herd animals, we copy each other. If you see other people doing a thing, you're more likely to do it yourself. So that's important. And there were lots of other sort of very important facets. Rachel Aldred in Westminster has written very well about how society often constructs the bike essentially as a toy, not as a mode of transport. And that kind of cultural higher level attitude is important. But what's fascinating is that thing you just said last. So there's a bunch of studies, especially from the geography world, which I'm kind of embarrassed saying this as a psychologist, but what they've shown is if you want to know whether people cycle, then you don't particularly want to know what they think. You know, what a person thinks or believes is much less important than what the road looks like, what the street looks like. So I remember an American study which found that the best predictor of whether a person cycled to work wasn't their attitude to cycling, it was, do you have a cycle path? And the same is true for walking and so on. And actually there's been some interesting work recently showing that there's cycles in this kind of thing. So the attitudes often follow the physical world. In other words, if a location, if a town, like your town here, builds new facilities, then fairly quickly that shifts people's attitudes. And fairly quickly people come round to think much more positively about using walking or cycling facilities.
Yeah, I mean,
because they've got them and they've tried
and
them.
And as an example, if you take someone from Abergavenny who is never going to ride a bike, and you give them a two-week holiday in Centre Parks, where you've got little bike trails all through the forests,
yeah,
and they get a free bike with their chalet,
yeah,
they'll be tootling around on a bike all the time.
Yeah, and then, of course, the minute they come home, they stop. And there's probably several reasons for that. You know, like we say, their, most importantly, their home environment doesn't facilitate it. But you've got to do more, you've got to do several things. And this is quite an important principle of trying to influence people's behaviour. There's at least at least two really important factors that are completely separate. You've got to motivate people to want to do a thing, but that's not enough. You've also got to tell them how to do it and make it possible to do that thing. And you've got to put all of those things in place, otherwise people's behaviour never changes.
So I've done a great job for myself there in forcing Ian to talk the entirety of the climb up to the pass at Penkenforth. How are you feeling, Ian?
Yeah, I think for people outside the country, it's important to realise that's like a 15% slope.
Oh yeah, at least. I mean, if not more. Yeah, we won't be travelling the King of the Mountain today, I don't think.
Yeah, I think I've not got Strava turned on, so...
So we're just up the pass here. On the right hand side is a pub that has a fantastic little kind of camping barn bunkhouse there where you can drink at the pub and just fall out of the pub into a comfortable and very good value bed.
Nice.
And we're on the edge of the Black Mountains, the western edge, and we're kind of at that point which I love around here where the sort of pastured land and the fields with their hedgerows and trees shades into the open moorland top, the kind of uncultivated land which is just rough grazing. There's a Welsh word for it, frieth, and I don't think there's an English word for it, but it's really nice where you sort of little pockets of rough land cut into the smooth grazed pastures, and we will soon get a glimpse of the Wye Valley, the Usk Valley behind us. What's that dead thing on the road there, Ian?
That looks like a pheasant.
That's a dead, yeah, quite. The crows have spent quite a while munching that down. Not much left but wing feathers and a beak.
I was telling someone the other day, when I was running, I had to have a full-on fight with a pheasant that refused to let me past and kept attacking my face. So it's probably not that many people who've punched a pheasant.
I found one in Eskdale in the Lake District when I was researching Lost Lanes North a couple of years ago. And it was still warm and it was perfectly intact. So I stuck it on the back of my bike and I took it to the youth hostel where I was staying. But I had to be really canny at the moment when I kind of... eviscerated it and prepared it for my supper, because I didn't think it was the kind of thing that the other guests in the youth hostel would want to witness.
No, well, yeah, rather you than me. I think I'll stick to Jaffa cakes and sandwiches.
It was good though. I just took out the two breasts and fried those, and then chucked the rest of it out for a fox to enjoy. So we're now going down, as you can probably hear. We're going to make a left on the first lane. I hope we've not missed it. So has your subsequent work been about cycling, or is that left all that behind you now?
In an ideal world, I think I would just do cycling research. You know, it's where my heart is, I love it. But what was very interesting, for a long time, you couldn't get anybody to fund it. It was like blood out of stone, trying to get even small amounts of money to look into cycling. Government didn't particularly care.
Left here.
People in the industry don't have the money. It's not like the car industry where the manufacturers are rolling in it. People who make bikes, people who make bike equipment, they're on tight budgets. They can't find money to fund research. So I kind of put it on the back burner. And I moved into other things, which
started out kind of related, like looking at why people choose to travel the way they choose to travel. You know, why do people choose to drive or cycle or walk or whatever. Now, I've done quite a lot of that. And then, kind of surprisingly, I started looking at other issues that are, to me, the same. As a psychologist, the theories, the models are very similar. So things like whether someone chooses to drive or cycle or walk, you can look at it with very similar approaches as the things I moved into, like why do people use so much energy or so much water, and how do you help people use less resources in more general environmental areas. And then I moved into all sorts of sort of slightly tangential civil engineering type things. Like I work on a project now on skyscrapers and the effects of tall buildings on its occupants.
A little sharp, short, sharp shock here. Yeah. Coming back out of the Wye Valley.
Yeah.
Lovely great mountain off to our left.
Oh, yes. It's an amazing view, but normally I wouldn't talk up a hill like this.
Well, I mean, you've got to be in zone two, isn't it? Zone two or something?
Exactly. Because I'd hung around for a long time and then moved into this more general environmental stuff, it's almost like the world caught up. So suddenly these days, there's a bigger interest in cycling issues or transport issues more generally, but for different reasons. So nowadays, people approach me and say, oh, you know, can you help us get people cycling more, walking more? But the motives have changed. So it used to be that people would talk to me like this because they just love bikes. Now it's because they're trying to solve climate emissions, or they're trying to solve congestion, or they're trying to address unhealthy, increasingly obese populations. It's all these kind of things. And in fact, these days, with the policymakers, often they've no interest in cycling whatsoever. You know, you might have, let's say, a councillor who's never ridden a bike, but they come and say, can you help us encourage people to cycle more? Just because they realise, from a completely hard-nosed, practical perspective, it's the best way of making use of space in the street, and it removes the need to clean up after motor vehicles, it removes the need to build expensive infrastructure for motoring, and you know, it's a way of getting people around their towns and cities so much more effectively. So it's just fascinating.
Well, that's really encouraging.
Yeah, but it's just amazing to see how the thing I'm interested in has come round, but the reasons behind it have changed completely.
We've got a beautiful view now over Llangorst Lake. What's that up there? Or a buzzard or something? I always assume it's a buzzard. I'm not very good on my birds.
No, I just always say eagle for everything.
Oh, right, there you go.
Sounds more impressive later.
So if it weren't for that clouds, we'll have a good view of the Brecon Beacons there. But they're actually looking quite nice, kind of being swallowed up by the low cloud and Llangorst Lake shining back at us.
Colours are lovely this morning. It's a dull day, but the greens and browns in the fields are just lovely.
Yeah, it's subtle, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think we're inching towards that time in the spring where it changes from kind of khakis and pewters to that sort of acid green of the first flush of spring. And the bluebells will soon be out. Yeah, I mean, we're on a very lost lane here, aren't we? This is on the western side of Mynyth Troed. I've ridden this, I think, once before. It's called Cockett Hill. And this is definitely getting towards 10%, isn't it?
I've got 15 on the computer.
You've got 15 on the computer.
Now people go realise I was lying about the earlier 15% hill. That was only 5 in reality. I can see a warning sign up ahead. I can't tell.
It's a cattle grid, I think.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
So as well as researching cycling, you do an awful lot of cycling.
Yeah.
And this long distance thing. When did you kind of get into long distance bike riding?
Well, surprisingly recently. So for a long time, so really through most of my 30s, I just didn't do anything. Yeah. I just didn't do any sort of sport or exercise, really. Did the occasional bit of poodling around on a bike, but that was it. And then, just as I was turning 40, I started...
You became a middle-aged man in Lycra?
Well, no, that's the thing. I had a different midlife crisis, and I started ultra-running.
Ultra-running?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
On an absolute whim. It was a complete... spur of the moment thing. A friend showed me this race, showed me a video of a race, and said, "Hey, look at this." And I said, "Right, let's do it." It's in the Canary Islands, and you start on a beach in the morning, and there's maybe 2,000 people. And as the sun comes up, you run up a volcano, and
that'd be the cattle grid.
That's the cattle grid. You run up a volcano. Round the top and down the other side, and it's whoop. That's the sound of me losing traction on the mud. So yeah, it's 73 kilometers, I think. And
wow, that's a long way to run.
Over 4,000 meters climbing, and it was pretty brutal, but I loved it. I started doing loads more running. I did maybe 3 years of long distance running. So for the record, that was 19% slope there. So.
Oh dear. You're doing well to keep the conversation going single-handedly. Oh. I'm dying here. That's the top now.
No one's going to believe this.
There's the top.
Oh. Wow.
So yeah, it's a lovely little nick in the hill here.
It's really pretty.
Cockett Hill.
I'd love to walk.
There's a great little walk up there, yeah. And hello, sheep. How you doing? Woo-hoo. So, let me guess. You did loads and loads of running.
Yep.
Bust your knees and had to take up cycling.
No. There's no reason to hurt your knees if you run well. It was actually another genuine spur of the moment thing. I was reading an article online, and I came across this article on the Transcontinental Race, which races from one side of Europe to the other every year, unsupported, 4,000 kilometres or thereabouts. Everyone's by themselves, you work out your own route. And the photos in this photo essay looked absolutely brutal. It looked so... It's just all these photos of people collapsed on the floor, asleep in checkpoints and things like this.
And that appealed to you?
Somehow, yeah.
How? Why?
There's got to be some sort of masochistic tendency in me, because I just thought that looks... I think what really grabbed me was, what would it be like to do something so all-encompassing? You know, I'd done races running where it takes all day, and that's amazing. You know, you don't appreciate how long 24 hours is till you've run it, but the idea of doing something that would take maybe 2 weeks and to just sort of hand myself over 100% to an experience that takes that long. I just wanted to know what that felt like.
But it's not just the fortnight or 10 days or whatever it is of racing. It's a whole lot of preparation to get there, to get to the start line, isn't it?
Absolutely. And one of the things I've really learned along the way from doing this sort of thing is that's the bit that matters. If you enjoy the racing and don't enjoy the 6 months of preparation beforehand, then what a miserable thing to do. I enjoyed the racing, but I also really, really enjoyed all the preparation and seeing myself get better and seeing myself get fitter. And you've got to love that bit. And I've got to say, I think the racing is an excuse to train. I don't train to be able to race.
Yeah. So did you just train yourself? Did you have a coach? Did you look up online how to get fit for a challenge like this?
Well, it's changed over the past 3 years. So the first year when I did the Transcontinental, I just completely winged it. The following year, I did a similar race, another cross Europe race called the North Cape 4000. And again,
I just did it myself. I got a bit more structured. I got a bit more, I did a bit of research, learnt a bit more about training and exercise and taught myself there. And then this past summer, I wanted to do something different. And so I had a go at the world record for crossing Europe. And I thought, well, if I'm going to do this, yeah, I was 45. I thought, if I'm going to do this, I've only really got one shot at this. And I don't want any possible regrets. I want to know I did everything that I could possibly do. And so I got a coach for that attempt.
And how was that experience different, having someone on your team, as it were, as opposed to just you doing it?
It was actually really nice. It was, we did it all remotely. I think we've only met face-to-face maybe four times. So she'd look after, this is Holly Sear, who's a fantastic cycle coach. She looked after the big picture stuff of, okay, well, we need to get you as fit as possible by this date here in 7 or 8 months. And then she worked everything back, got the whole cycle worked out. And then from my perspective, it took away so much thinking. All I had to do was turn on my bike computer every morning and that day's exercise would be on there. And often that was just like, ride to work really gently and don't get your heart rate up. And that was a huge part of it, was just getting those miles in. But then other days it would be specific exercises, specific intervals, and having someone to do the thinking for me. And the reassurance that gives you that somebody who knows what they're doing has chosen today's activity, and that you know that that fits into a bigger picture. There's none of that niggling doubt of, should I be doing something else? Should I be doing more? Should I be doing less? Because someone who knows what they're doing is taking care of
that. So she was setting you the kind of assignments, you were doing them, and while you were doing them, you were recording all the information about your power output, heart rate and all that kind of stuff. And that, yeah, she was getting that back and sort of looking at that and then, yeah, helping to inform what she'd set you up for the next time. So kind of, yeah, an iterative process, was it?
That's exactly right.
You were, yeah, just like looking up a book and go, okay, yeah, you know, I've got a 60-day training plan, yeah, and they're all here day 1 through 60, yeah, and you just have to do that.
Absolutely. And part of it is that need to be flexible. So if you're having a day where your body's just not got it, then on the one hand, a coach can be good for saying, that's fine, look, we'll cancel tomorrow's thing or we'll change it to something easier, that's not a problem. And on the other hand, probably more importantly, it's having someone with experience to be able to go, it's okay. You know, yeah, you really struggled to do those hills today. That happens. It's fine. You know, that's not a problem. Whereas if you're just doing it yourself, it's easy to get into a pattern of sort of beating yourself up of, you know, oh, God, you know, I couldn't get up those hills. I've ridden them before. Is my training going backwards? And having a wiser head to look after you can be really useful.
And how much better were you as a result of that? How much faster did you cross Europe than you would have done, you know, in your transcontinental year, do you think?
Oh, that's a tough question, because it goes very different routes.
Is there any way of evaluating how much faster or stronger or more endurance you had?
I'd need to check my geeky spreadsheets, but I think probably the best comparison is the North Cape 4000 race and the Trans-Europe record attempt. Because they were kind of much more comparable landscapes. And often, in fact, the roads overlapped on those two. I reckon I was probably consistently doing the record attempt 20-25 watts harder.
What's that as a percentage?
Well, I was probably doing the whole thing. My sort of cruising along speed was probably a good 2 to 3 kilometres an hour faster.
So that's significant, isn't it?
That really adds up over 16 days.
Yeah. And so it was 16 days, was it?
16 days, 20 hours and 59 minutes.
You got it tattooed on you somewhere.
I should do, shouldn't I? Yeah.
And along the way, you didn't have a sort of paddy wagon behind you just kind of to look after you. You just had, yeah, to kip in a hedge, did you, and buy your food from petrol stations in a transcontinental race style?
Yeah, I was really keen to do it unsupported. I think it kind of feels more, it was more what I'm familiar with, let's be honest, but it feels also kind of more democratic, that if I have a crack at a record and it's just me and no help, then anybody else at all can come along and have a go, and it's fair and it's a level playing field. So yeah, it was just me with a credit card, and I would find hotels if I could find them and just buy my food in petrol stations and make it up as I went along, in large part.
And how many hours were you riding and how many hours were you not riding each day, typically?
I was riding more disciplined than I had in the past. So the previous two events were both kind of 11, 12 days riding, something like that. And you can actually, I don't want to call that a short ride, but you can kind of get away with pushing yourself into the red over 7, 8, 9, 10 days. And especially with sleep, you can push into the night, get down to less and less sleep. And so on the North Cape 4000, I was well into the red by the end. I was scraping by on a couple of hours sleep a night on the last couple of days, and I couldn't have gone much further doing that. And I realised that to cross Europe, which was going to be, you know, more like 16, 17, 18 days, depending on the weather, I couldn't push myself into the red that much. So the goal was to ride about 16 hours a day of moving, which would allow me maybe, let's say, an hour and a half during that time to rest. And then that left me fairly cosy 6.5 hours every evening, which was, you know, quite a generous break for this sort of ultra-distance stuff. So 6.5 hours in the evening to sort the bike out, eat dinner and sleep. And so that way, I think with that schedule of 16 hours riding, hour and a half during the day to eat and sort stuff out, and then 6.5 hours in the evening, I could probably have gone indefinitely like that.
But you know what I'm thinking? I'm thinking there's someone who's going to have a go at it and is going to allocate themselves 4 hours to do all that stuff. And they're going to think that's 2 hours that I'm going to be riding when Ian was, you know, having his three-course dinner and half a bottle of wine.
Yeah, well, do you know, and this is what's fascinating about, this is what I love about the ultra-distance world, that there's more than one way to be good at it. So there are some riders out there, people who do well in races, and they are way stronger than me. They can put out far much power than I can. In fact, a really good example would be one of the guys on the North Cape 4000 race who, you know, we kept bumping into each other all the time for the first week. And he was obviously stronger than me, but he needed more sleep. He couldn't get by on the sleep I can get by on. I think I was also probably more disciplined in shops. I would grab food and go, whereas he would always sit around and eat and have a proper meal. And, you know, so as a raw physical rider, he was much better, but I beat him in the race.
I have a thing when if I'm a bit tired after a long day and I stop to get some food or whatever, and I still know I've got some time to go, I get this thing which my friend Matt calls getting vague. And he's like, Jack, are you getting vague? And because I kind of just, I sort of stop making decisions and I just sort of stand around and look a bit glazed and can't decide what to buy. And then just time is passing and I'm just kind of not engaging with anything.
I think that's probably because you're not eating enough. You know, genuinely, that is...
It's not a full-on bonk. It's just a sort of, whoa, what's happening? You know, I can't run this show anymore.
No, I think that probably is, actually, I would say a mild bonk.
A mild bonk.
Because, yeah, I think in long-distance riding, 90% of anything that doesn't quite feel right is because you're not eating enough.
Right. Oh, that's a good tip. Well, we better roll down this hill. We're being overtaken by the sheep and get back onto the fast road. We're back in the Usk Valley. That was a great descent off Cockett Hill, wasn't it?
Oh, amazing. Really good swoop down.
And I seem to have picked up a couple of thorns or something like that because the last mile or two has been a tubeless tyre disaster. Ian, you've been very kindly tutoring me in the arts of tubeless repair with anchovies. This is all new to me, this new bike of mine. It's the first time I've had tubeless. So I have to say, I'm not very impressed.
Yeah, I do find tubeless to be a bit hit and miss on road bikes. Yeah, I still can't decide after like maybe 30,000 kilometres. I still can't decide if I like them or not.
So you've got to get back to Bristol, which is about 70 kilometres away. So I'm going to let you speed off, a record breaker that you are. What have you got lined up? Well, we don't know what any of us are going to be doing this year with this coronavirus around. But are you going to be doing lots of cycling and more psychology?
I'll certainly be doing more psychology. The cycling is interesting. I've actually just been making some decisions recently. I was planning another
cross-continental race. And I'm entered, and I'm pretty sure they'll cancel it soon with the coronavirus. But I have to say, my heart wasn't in it. For some reason, I just couldn't get myself excited about racing the way I did the last two or three years. And I realised just recently, it's because if I was to do another big race like that, I'm kind of just doing the same thing that I've done before again. And it doesn't let me push myself to do something novel, which I've realised is actually quite important to me. So the thing I'm excited about is kind of doing silly things on the bike this year. I want to, circumstances allowing, I want to just go off and set myself crazy challenges this year. I think that's really exciting me. So maybe one option I'm talking about is trying to do the entire border of Wales, for example, which I know from experience is absolutely horrible. But if I could do, say, the whole Welsh border in 4 days, for example, that would be an amazing thing to pull off. And so I like the idea of just setting myself some silly challenges this year and having some fun doing it.
Well, if you do that one, then I'll come out and ride along with you for a bit if I can keep up. And research wise have you got stuff that's kind of interest from the transport planning kind of cycling side of things?
What's interesting is I think what's going to be a big part of my research this year is not going to be the cycling. And I've come to a really difficult realization. I do quite a lot of work with the civil engineers, particularly on work to help civil engineers and architects use less materials. You know, because if you think of how much concrete gets used in skyscrapers and so on, it's vast amounts. We've got a project going on at the moment called V-Simulators, where we've got a virtual skyscraper that we can shake around to our heart's content and test how it affects people. And although it doesn't excite me in the way that travel and cycling research does, if we can get this right, we can help everybody build all future buildings with 40% less material. And just in terms of a contribution to the world, saving 40% of the world's building materials is a vastly bigger contribution than I could ever make getting people cycling more. So I will certainly keep going.
How does psychology work in with concrete and formulations of concrete?
Well, the engineers have shown that you could make buildings with far less concrete. And we did a study a couple of years ago showing how they get over-engineered. You know, the sort of social processes that lead to them being over-engineered. The psychological aspect is, if we build them lighter, they will move more. They will sway in the wind. And so we desperately need to know, how much can we get away with? How will it affect people? How do you counteract it? Will it be as simple as just like warnings on a plane, just saying, hey, it's going to be windy today, you're going to feel it. Maybe that's all that's needed, but we need to test it.
Fascinating. Sounds fascinating. Well, thank you very much for coming out for this ride up the closed road up to Penkenforth, and hope you make it back in time for your students.
Thank you. It's been really nice scenery. I've loved it. And that lovely little closed road and the brutal little hills just off it were fantastic.
Right, well, we'll race back the last bit. I'll show you the way out of town and see if I can give you a little tow before I completely expire or my rear tyre does the same.
I was riding with Dr. Ian Walker of the University of Bath. Thanks for listening. And wherever you are, however locked down you are, I hope you and those close to you are keeping well and keeping sane, and that you're managing somehow to keep the pedals turning. Until next time, goodbye.